Welcome to Dinosaur George Kids, a show for anyone who loves dinosaurs. Dinosaur George has studied paleontology for over 50 years and has performed live to over 4 million students across the world. So sit back and enjoy today's show. Now, here's Dinosaur George.
Hey there, future paleontologists. I'm Dinosaur George. Welcome to the podcast. This is podcast number 95. I hope everybody is doing well. This is going to be a little bit different podcast than those of the past. I'll explain that in just a minute. But first of all, I want to cover a couple of things that I am so proud of and so excited about. And that is the number of listeners that we have and where they are from. So as many of you had listened before may have recalled, we broke the 1 million listener mark or the 1 million download mark at the beginning of the year. So right now we are at 1,026,712 downloads of this podcast. We are heard in 180 countries and in 15,721 cities around the world. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to tell you the top 10s. We'll start with the top 10 countries that listen to me. Now, keep in mind that this, you know, there are countries that have more people than other countries. So just because your country isn't on here doesn't mean you're not an important listener. It just simply means some of these have more citizens than yours. So at number 10, South Africa. Listeners in South Africa, that's the number 10 country that we are heard in. At number 9 is Japan. Number 8 is India. Number 7 is Germany. Number 6 is New Zealand. Number 5 is Ireland. Number 4 is Australia. Number 3 is the United Kingdom. Number 2 is Canada. And number 1 is the United States. So that's the top 10 countries where I'm listened to. And to give you an idea how close this really is, it's like Australia is only 7,000 listeners away from ranking number 2 in the world. So that's how close Canada, United Kingdom, and Australia are. They are really, really close to each other. So, man, that's close. Now let's talk about the top 10 cities. This is pretty exciting, and this is an eye-opener for me because it's not what I thought it was going to be. At number 10 is Ontario, Toronto, Canada. They're the number 10 city that listens to me. At number 9 is Houston, Texas. At number 8, Portland, Oregon. At number 7, Brisbane, Queensland. At number 6, San Antonio. That surprises me. I would have thought San Antonio would have been the number 1. That's where I'm from. At number 5, Perth, Western Australia. Number 4, Alberta, Calgary, Canada. Number 3, Seattle, Washington. Number 2, Melbourne, Victoria. And the number 1 city that listens to me in the world is Sydney in New South Wales. How incredible is that? That's pretty crazy. Never would have guessed which cities would have been on that top 10 list. I would have absolutely bet San Antonio because that's where I'm from. But anyway, I want to thank all of you, no matter where you are, no matter if your country or your city, whether your community even made the top 10 list, that's irrelevant. I appreciate every one of you, and I'm so glad. And the reason why we're heard in so many places is because you tell your friends. It's basically that. You tell your family and friends. That's how this channel grows. I don't advertise it. I don't promote it. It's simply through you. All right. I do a lot of things, the podcast being one of them. But the other one is Patreon. We offer a Patreon club. Well, I am happy to say that I have an assistant who helps me with Patreon, helps me more than he ever would know. That is my assistant, Noah. I've asked Noah to come onto this podcast today. Noah, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. So, Noah, how old are you now?
I am 14 on the cusp of turning 15, actually on February 2nd.
Old man. An old man. So Noah does so much for me. Now, Noah, you've loved dinosaurs since you were a kid, right?
Yes, sir. Always have.
Now, you study something that a lot of people don't understand. You study the family lineages of these animals. Explain kind of what your specialty is.
So basically, my specialty is phylogenetics. And what phylogenetics are is basically just mapping out the family tree of life. I particularly focus on dinosaurs. And with that, now it used to be for me is I just look at the whole tree. What does this tree does? Okay, this guy connects to this guy. They're the closest relative. But that's not really what it's all about. And that's what a lot of people think it is. It's really about going into these smaller niches, and then you learn about the animals and how this phylogeny relates to this animal and its paleobiology, how it lived, where it lived, what is its family doing, what is it going, when did it become extinct, why did it become extinct. And that's something really special to me, I feel like.
That's pretty exciting, and that takes into a much deeper level. I mean, it's fun to learn about different dinosaurs, and that's cool, but it's really amazing to really understand that dinosaur. We talk about predators, and everybody says T-Rex. That's cool. Well, how did T-Rex, where did he come from? Well, you can use phylogenetics to go backwards in time to see how and who it's related to and how it ended up where it is and why is it in that family. What caused it to be in part of that family? Because if you look at an Allosaurus and you look at a Tyrannosaurus on the outside, they look very similar, but they're not related to each other very closely at all. Phylogenetics exactly. would demonstrate that they both are on a different plane from each other. They all came from the same area, but very distinctively branched in a different family.
Yes, sir. Exactly. That's the thing that I love about phylogenetics. See, one of the key things in life for me in studies of paleontology is I used to be this way. Basically, just memorize as many facts as you can and get those down. That's all well, but you really have to understand the facts, understand the animal. And that has helped me so much recently because, I mean, I can tell you T-Rex about 40 feet long, teeth the size of bananas, hunted triceratops we have. Evidence for that. That's all well, but why was it 40 feet long? Where did it come from? Why did it become so big? We know it hunted triceratops. Why did it hunt triceratops other than animals? How did this impact the ecosystem? That's all really key.
Right. Very good. So Patreon, for our members, we do a lot of things, but one of the things that I don't promote that much, but I need to, is your involvement in Patreon and the things you are doing that make Patreon very interactive and fun. Tell us about some of the things you do for our Patreon members.
Well, let me think. It's kind of a lot now. It's really grown from when I just started. When I first started, really my only task was I did a few polls and, new discoveries. Now I do a lot of fun stuff, but really my two biggest tasks are reporting new discoveries. There's this new dinosaur discovery in the news. What I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the news article. I'm going to research this in depth. I'm going to give you and tell you about it and help you understand it and give you the link. I do polls. Some of them are pretty fun. Just like, what's your favorite dinosaur? Is it T-Rex or Spinosaurus? Or sometimes it's a little more serious and gets to make you think. Like, why do we find more dinosaurs that lived in the desert other than dinosaurs that lived in the rainforest, even though rainforests normally have more animals? And, I mean, I do some more special events like the Tournament of Dinosaurs, for example. Actually, I'm on my fourth season. I've been doing it for 4 years
That's
now.
Crazy.
I'm starting to feel old.
You!
me? So, I mean, it's pretty fun. All in all, it's really fun. And then I help out on our Zoom lessons on the Patreon Club, which are absolute blast. I love them. What I'll do is I'll help answer questions. I do some polls during the lessons, which is always fun to get to see the reactions of the members to the polls, like live action. It's always fun.
Well, that's cool. Well, you really helped me a bunch. I want you to know how much I appreciate it, because with my busy schedule, I don't get to interact as much on Patreon. But what's cool is when you go on there and you click on it, page after page after page of information, new discoveries, games. I mean, it's just so cool, and I appreciate it. So what I decided to do with this podcast is, rather than me talk about a feature creature, this time I'm going to answer questions submitted by you, but I'm going to have Noah input his answers as well, because I think it would be fun to get a different perspective on things. And I want to try to maybe start inviting some specialists in on this podcast to make it even more entertaining. So anyway, that's what we're going to do today, is we're going to jump in and we're just going to start answering questions. So I'm going to read the questions and I'll choose the ones I want to answer, and I'll send those over to you that I would like for you to answer to get your opinion on. We'll do some questions and we'll do some who would wins as well. But the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you 5 bullet point questions. You can only answer with one answer.
Here we go again.
What's your favorite hadrosaur?
Oh,
you got hadrosaur. One answer.
Okay. C.
Wrong. There is no hadrosaur named C. Question number 2. I'm kidding you. Who's your favorite hadrosaur?
I'm not a big fan of hadrosaur, so this
you
is
have
tough.
To like one, whether you like it or not. You have to name one.
Loratitan.
What a horrible choice. All right. Next, what's your favorite sauropod?
Favorite sauropod? Oh, Diplodocus.
Nice. Go with the classic. What's your favorite ceratopsian?
Favorite ceratopsian is probably Cosmoceratops.
Nice. Favorite ankylosaur?
Favorite ankylosaur? Oh, I'm having a mind blank, but it's this super cool ankylosaur that we learned about together on a lesson.
What is his name?
We call it the Darth Vader ankylosaur.
Yes, that's exactly right. I can't remember its name either, but I know what you're talking about. We named it Darth Vader ankylosaur. It was wicked looking.
It's awesome.
I forgot his name as well. Favorite theropod?
Oh, boy. This is tough. Today, it always changes for me, but I'm going to go with Spino.
Nice. All right, my favorite hadrosaur is Allosaurus. My favorite sauropod is Allosaurus. My favorite ceratopsian is Allosaurus. My favorite ankylosaur is Allosaurus. My favorite theropod is Diplodocus. Okay, moving on. Now we're going to...
Best list I've ever heard.
All right, let's jump into some Q&As. This one comes from Cha-Cha-Cha Raptor Wyatt, who said, what is the process of digging up bones? Well, I just came back from Montana in August, and so let me tell you what it is. Number one is you have to know what layers of dirt you're looking at to be able to know where to look. So the first process is figuring out where the layer of dirt that you're looking for is found. Then it's a process of two things. You can do two things. You can just walk and look and hope you see something that is eroded out of the ground. Or if you are in an environment that is rich in fossils, you can sit down and just start digging. I did both of those last August. Last August, I just traversed a huge amount of area looking at the ground. I found little teeth, found bone fragments. But in the other location, I sat there and I just started digging and slowly moving dirt. And the next thing you know, something will emerge out of it. And so those are the processes. Now, finding it is one thing. Extracting it is the next process. And that is where you clean all the dirt away from the bone. You don't simply pick the bone up. You are removing the dirt from around the bone so that the bone is sitting there. You generally will put glue on it to hold the pieces together because they're usually broken into parts. So you put a lot of glue on it to hold it together. Finally, you undercut the rock under it or dirt under it, and you remove the bone that way. You take it back to a laboratory, and that's where you're under better conditions. You can clean it and prep it and have it ready to go. So those are basically it. Now, Baron Raptor 6 wants to know which dinosaur was the fastest. What is your opinion on the fastest dinosaur?
Fastest dinosaur. It's a really tough question, but I feel like we have two headrunners. obviously the ornithomimosaurs, the ostrich mimic dinosaurs, and possibly some species of raptor. I feel like for me, the ornithomimosaurs are the head runner. I believe some studies suggest speeds of 45 miles per hour, which is really impressive. That's about the same speed as a horse.
Right. Yeah, Ornithomimus, Teuthiomimus, Dromaeosimimus, that group, I agree with you. Those probably, and that's based on the length of their legs, the length of their femur compared to their lower leg bones, the tibia and fibula. And then also using dinosaur footprints and applying those footprints to a species helps estimate speed. But based on those things, I agree with you that it would have been the Mimus family or Allosaurus. Okay. Megaleodon wants to know two things. How tall was a giant ground sloth and how many teeth does a T-Rex have? All right, I'll start with the ground sloth. Depends on the species. There's a variety of species of ground sloths. The biggest is Megatherium, and I believe it is 20 feet tall, sitting on its back legs. These animals walked on all fours but could stand up. Standing on its back legs, I believe 20 feet is the answer. Do you have a different opinion for that part of his question?
No, sir. I believe that's dead on.
Okay. Now, the tough one, how many teeth does a Tyrannosaurus Rex have? You want to try to answer that?
50 to 60.
Nice.
On average.
Right. And you say that, we say that because their jaws are not identical. Some have more teeth than others. And the other thing you have to consider is, what do you consider a tooth? Because like sharks, they have, we call them seed teeth, like a seed, like a plant seed that grows. There are little teeth under its teeth that are continuously growing that will ultimately push the other one out. If you included those, you might have 120 teeth.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. Definitely.
Right? So that's a great question. The answer is going to be the teeth you see. And I agree with you. It's between 50 and 60 teeth. And again, they're not all identical. Like most humans, most of us have the same number of teeth, but there are some people that have more teeth than others. It's just an anomaly. All right, good question. Okay, this is from Phoebe Cephalosaurus. Were any of the animals in the Permian period dinosaurs, or were they all just proto-mammals and insects? You want to take this one first?
Yes, sir. So that's an interesting question. So first off, no, they were not all just proto-mammals and insects. There weren't any dinosaurs either. So in the Permian, we have a wide variety of animals. We have amphibians. We have reptiles. We have insects. We have fish. We have worms. But in more relation to your question, we have very early relatives of dinosaurs called archosaurs present in the Permian. And so these animals, actually archosaurus itself was from the Permian, which gave its name to the group. These animals gave rise to crocodiles, dinosaurs, and birds. So yes, there were some dinosaur ancestors, but no actual dinosaurs.
That's exactly right. There were the actual dinosaurs themselves do not appear until the Triassic period. But Noah's right. Archosaurs were the animals that ultimately led to the evolution of dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were a branch off of the archosaur family. You have crocodilians, you have dinosaurs, you have pterosaurs, you have swimming reptiles. All of those have lineages back to animals of the Permian. But the great extinction that occurred at the end of the Permian is what opened the door for the dinosaurs to take over. So had it not been for the big extinction at the Permian, many of us today would have sails on our back and we would be growling and biting each other. That was really good. All right. Phoebe Cephalosaurus also asked, if carnivores evolved into modern day birds, then what did herbivore dinosaurs evolve into? All right, I'll take this. Okay, birds evolved from one group of the carnivores, from the raptor group. They evolved from that. But herbivores, there are no animals that evolved from them that continued in today. You could say lizards and reptiles, but lizards and reptiles are related and were there with the dinosaurs. So I cannot think of any plant-eating dinosaur that has any living relative today that went past the end of the Cretaceous period. The extinction at the end of the Cretaceous period caused the extinction of what we refer to as the terrestrial dinosaurs. The avian dinosaurs continued on, and those are birds. So, Noah, do you have a different opinion, or are you aware of something different than that?
Yes, sir. Herbivorous dinosaurs evolved into dust and rock.
So they became dirt.
Practical.
So the next time you breathe in dirt, you just breathed in a dinosaur.
Beautiful.
For those kids that are always picking their nose, and I'm talking to all the boys, and your mom yells, stop picking your nose, you can go, hey, I think there's a Brachiosaurus in here. I got to get it out.
You never know.
Look, mom, I picked an Ankylosaurus. Oh, that's just great. You parents are going to kill me for that. Okay, so that's great. So yeah, so I agree. That was a very interesting question, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay. This one is from Demian, a.k.a. D-Rex, says, hey, El Stinko, this question, how strong is Triceratops' horns? Thank you, little Georgie Pants. Well, first of all, I don't even know who this El Stinko person is, but I know it's not me. And I'm not little Georgie Pants. And stop people calling me names, because that's terrible. I am not El Stinko. No one knows the identity of El Stinko. Okay, so Noah, what could you give as an example of how strong you think the Triceratops horns are?
So, for Triceratops horn, basically its horn would be about as strong as a rhino's horn, pretty much. But it's really not the horn that really transmits power into an animal. It's really the animal driving the horn. But for the horn itself, how strong it would be, like under pressure, if that's what your question is, it would be relatively strong. I can't give you an exact answer because to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have no studies as of late to how much pressure Triceratops horn could withstand. We've only really had that for the frill. And for the Triceratops horns, I believe we've had some studies showing if it could puncture. But right. Other than that, I don't think we have much evidence.
One thing that we don't find is a lot of broken horns caused when they were alive. We don't find many examples. I can't think of any example of a broken and healed horn. Now, see, when we find them and dig them up, they're broken a lot. But that's in the fossilization process. I'm talking about a horn that was broken, that clearly the animal broke the horn and lived through it, because the horn would then show evidence of healing. And I'm not aware of any horn. I am aware of horns being damaged through predation, but I'm talking about a snapped horn that broke during a battle. We do have evidence of horns penetrating frills. So it certainly suggests that it's not a very common occurrence. And when you take the size of the animal and the momentum of that animal and the impact that would have occurred, if the horns were being shattered, we would see that. And therefore, it suggests to me that they are incredibly strong. They were covered in keratin. The keratin may chip and break. That's normal. But the actual horn itself, it's not very common. That I've never seen one that I can think of. Have you ever seen one or heard of one before, Noah?
I believe, not just being snapped because it was weak, I think we have one of a Tyrannosaurus that actually broke it. But, I mean, I don't think that really counts.
Right. Because breaking something by biting onto the side of it or into it is different than the application of it hitting something and the force of that breaking it. So exactly. Because it's not common to find much evidence, I can't think of any ceratopsian that I've ever seen a broken and healed horn.
I can't think of any either. I mean, it's for me, just imagine a triceratops horn as a stick. If triceratops horns were huge, I know you have a replica, and I mean, that thing is huge.
Right.
That thing is
huge. It's enormous.
It's exactly. So basically, you could do it at home. If you have a fence or let's say a rock and you put a twig, if it's a really small one and you press it against it, it's going to break. But if you put a big one, it's going to take a lot more force and pressure to break. So for Triceratops, it's really a big stick. It's hard to break something that big, that thick and armored.
Right. Okay. That was great. All right. This is from Owen Adon. What do you think the world would be like if dinosaurs were still alive? I'll let you answer first.
Scary. Very, very scary.
Yeah.
I feel like we would not have a form of civilization like we do now. No way we could. Dinosaurs would be so much better than us. I think we would be nocturnal. We would not be like how we are today. I believe if dinosaurs were still around today, not counting birds, because they are dinosaurs and still alive, but it would be a lot more terrifying. And I feel like dinosaurs would continue. It wouldn't be that much different than how they would be. I feel like we may see less grass. Less grass would probably be the biggest difference I could think of, because studies have shown that dinosaurs didn't really prefer angiosperms, which are the flowering plants, and grass is actually considered a type of flowering plants. So for me, the biggest difference would be no grass.
That's good. Certainly, hang on a second. I'm sending you a message. Certainly, we would not be in a position where we would be able to survive with dinosaurs. The question would become, what would the dinosaurs be like? I personally believe that they would have grown smaller in size based on today's environment, today's percentage of oxygen. I am of the opinion that they would be smaller. So maybe humans would have a foothold. Maybe it would be possible for humans to survive alongside of them. But I believe that they would have been smaller. It's a great question. Okay, Emery Rex wants to know, when did Indoraptor exist? Indoraptor. Isn't that the one from Jurassic?
That's the one from Jurassic Park.
Right. So that is not a...
Wasn't it supposed to be like around 2015 or something?
Yeah. Indoraptor is the one that they made in the laboratory. So it would have been, I don't believe that's an accurate dinosaur. I think Indoraptor is a made up dinosaur.
Kind of a thing.
Right. Right. That's exactly right. Okay. Good question, Emery. Okay. Starviraptor and mommy would like to know if you think dinosaurs, specifically ones that use their tail as a weapon, could intentionally move their tail like we wiggle our fingers, or do they just swish it like a ball at the end of a rope? That's an excellent question. Okay. The tails are connected to the body. The tails are connected to the body through vertebra. They make the tail vertebra. So they cannot move them up and down very easily, but they can move them from side to side. So they do not have a lot of motion. They don't have a big range of motion. It's side to side, but there's a reason for that. Because if their tail was wiggly and limber like our fingers, they cannot hit with any sort of force because it would basically bend backwards. So imagine if you used your fingers to hit something. Well, your fingers are going to bend backwards and it's not going to be as impactful as if you made a fist and punched something. So the tails are not made for any range of motion. They couldn't wiggle it. They could swing it from side to side. And your point about like a ball on the end of the rope, that's not necessarily a good description because that would swing free. It's more like a baseball bat with a big round club on the end. Stiff, but mobile. What's your opinion of that?
Pretty much the same thing. We have vertebrae. Animals have vertebrae to basically help control their tail motions. If it was just wiggling all around like a loose noodle, it wouldn't serve a purpose because tails are used as a form of balance. They are a balancing agent most of the time. So basically what you said.
Right. Good. Okay. Alice in Dinoland said, do you know much about the dinosaurs found in New Zealand? Noah, do you know of any dinosaur in New Zealand?
There are dinosaurs. They don't have any firm names, though. I do so believe, this is just from the top of my head, I believe Cryolophosaurus may have been found in the New Zealand part of Antarctica. So I don't know if you count that. But there, I know there are some ornithomimids, some theropods, titanosaurs, theropods, compsognathans. I believe we have an ankylosaur. But mostly New Zealand has a better record of marine reptiles, like pronathodon, tyrannosaurus, which was featured on Prehistoric Planet, if anybody has ever watched that.
Right.
So, I mean, it's, and I believe we also have a nothosaur, which I kind of like. So it's mostly known for its marine reptiles other than its dinosaurs.
Right. One of the issues about different places in the world was two things. One, what layer of Earth is exposed at the surface that they can see? And two, what are the conditions for the fossilization process? Sometimes we find the layers that hold the bones, but the environment is so rough and so flexible and mobile, meaning that earthquakes, tectonic plate movements can grind those fossils into pieces. So we don't find complete skeletons. Finding parts helps us determine what family they belong to or may belong to, but it doesn't help us always narrow down which species. So the list of species may not be available to us, but the list of families are. And as Noah went through and mentioned, there are a lot of animals that were living there, but to my knowledge and to Noah's knowledge, no complete skeleton or recognizable skeletons have been found. It's a great question. Okay. Five-year-old Xavier, or Javier, depending on how you pronounce it, in Sydney, it's probably Xavier, would like to know about his favorite dinosaur, the Amargosaurus. Why can't paleontologists agree on whether Amargosaurus had spikes or a sail on its back? Thanks, El Stinko. Well, you're welcome. What did you just call me? What did that kid just call me?
Super awesome dinosaur George, who is the best guy ever.
Okay, yeah, I misread it. I thought it said El Stinko. Okay, so why? Oh, so Noah, I'm going to ask this to you. They have fossils in front of them. Why can't they agree what it looks like? Were there sail? Was there skin on it between the spikes? Was it just the spikes? How come everybody can't agree?
This is one of the trickier questions in paleontology, which is kind of part of a bigger debate. So for Amargosaurus, we have a fossil of it, but all we have are spikes on it. So we don't know if it had a sail on its back. That is just pure speculation. It would possibly make sense for a sail. There may be some possible attachment sites on the vertebrae, which could be a spot for the sail to attach to. Those aren't really firm. So it's not like Spinosaurus, if it had a sail, because we know it had a sail because of how the spines are arranged. It's a bit more questionable for a Amargosaurus. So this is really kind of up to you. There's not really right or wrong answers in paleontology. Do you want to stick with the fossils we have? This is what we have. it has spikes? Or do you want to make comparisons, go out to your own research, study other modern day animals and other dinosaurs and say, this dinosaur probably had a cell because of this reason and this reason. This is up to you. So go out and do your own research on this. That's my best advice.
Fossils can tell us a lot, but they can't tell us everything. If somebody finds my skeleton 10,000 years from now, they may not be able to tell what color my eyes were. And they can argue all day long. I believe that his eyes were blue. Why do you believe that? Well, because looking at a skeleton, it appears to be European in nature, meaning I probably had ancestors that came from Europe. And a lot of males have blue eyes in Europe. And therefore, I think his eyes were blue. Somebody else could say he was found in a southern part where he was closer to South America. A lot of people in South America and in Mexico have brown eyes. Therefore, I think his eyes were brown. Neither one may be able to prove their hypothesis, but both can have a legitimate guess. When Noah mentioned the attachment points on vertebrae, when you look at a bone is not always smooth. There's little tiny anchor points where things can connect to it, like muscles. So if there was skin between those spikes, there should be something that demonstrates that the skin connected to them. But it's not visible because of the when they decompose, maybe they left no evidence. So you won't find. Let me say this. The greatest thing about science is that it's not something designed for everybody to agree on everything. That's not science. Science is looking at the evidence and making a hypothesis, your educated guess. The only thing is you have to use facts to make your guess. You can't make them up. I can't say that Tyrannosaurus Rex was pink with blue polka dots because there's no animal there. There's nothing like that. I can't say it. That's just a guess. That doesn't mean anything. But I can say that I believe based on the environment it lived in, it was striped like a tiger or spotted like a leopard, because therefore that would help it in its environment to hide. I may not be able to prove either one, but at least I have a basis of my evidence. A Margosaurus is pretty cool, isn't it?
It is, yes, sir.
Okay, Raja Gramosaurus wants to know, hey, El Stinko, would dinosaurs... Okay, what? Enough with this, El Stinko! Would dinosaurs evolve differently if Indoraptor and Indominus were real? Wow. All right.
Okay, this is...
Evolution of dinosaurs. I'll start this one. Animals adapt and evolve based on their environment. Brachiosaurus has a long neck because of where it lived and what food was available to it. Ankylosaurus is armored because it needs to be protected from the predators. If Indominus Rex and Indoraptor were living in something's environment, in my opinion, I think they would have evolved more weapons. What say you, Noah?
I was going to say the exact same thing. Large scale, no. It wouldn't impact dinosaurs that much. The entire dinosauria, it wouldn't impact the earliest dinosaurs or dinosaurs later. If Indominus was real, I would probably put it in a place like early Cretaceous Argentina with some really big sauropods, or in the Morrison Formation. And it would impact the animals that lived there before a short amount of time. It's not sustainable for an animal to survive for a ridiculous amount of time. On average, an animal species exists for around 1 million years. That's it. If it doesn't, it becomes unhealthy or a parasite, and the environment will actually start kind of pushing back on it. It's just natural how it goes. So overall, not so much, but like Dinosaur George said, more armor for the animals, but other than that, I don't see really that much change overall.
Okay. Maxosaurus Rex wants to know why Spinosaurus had a sail, but Baryonyx didn't, if they both fed on the same food and both were semi-aquatic. I'll let you check this one first.
This is one of the trickiest questions in paleontology, right here. We're having some tricky ones today.
Mm-hmm.
For Spinosaurus, well, we know he has a cell, first of all. This is really tough. But Spinosaurus, the best guess probably for me is Spinosaurus had a cell because Spinosaurus spent more time in the water. Baryonyx had a minor hump, which probably served the same purpose, if I had to guess. It probably was used as an agent of thermoregulation, basically helping keep your body temperature warm. If you take a shower and you step out of the shower, it's really cold. Your body is cold. Water takes the heat out of you. So that cell would probably help Spinosaurus and help keep a body temperature and warm up. So probably why Spinosaurus has a much bigger cell than Baryonyx is that he spent more time in the water than Baryonyx. We have some studies showing that Baryonyx probably was more of a land animal, if I had to guess.
And I agree completely. I do believe that is, I think there's two answers. One is that Spinosaurus was living with another predator that was just as big, and therefore it probably spent most of its time in the water because they were dividing the food source. And because he's in the water more, he's got to regain heat loss through the water, and that giant sail acted as a solar panel. And the other reason would be that its size, its sheer size, would have taken more to warm up if it was relying on the ambient temperature outside. So Baryonyx has some of the features of being a fish eater, but also some of the features of living on land. I do not know who lived with Baryonyx at the same time in the same place. I think it might have been one of the largest predators, if not the largest predator. And therefore, it doesn't need to divide the food source. It can take advantage of the water food source, but it's not spending as much time. That's excellent. That's very good. Here's another Triceratops question. Jude would like to know, this is from Judasaurus. Jude would like to know, we read that the horns of Triceratops were too thin to be used in defense against a predator and instead were just for show. Is this true? Let me say this. First of all, just because something is written doesn't mean that it is shared or believed by the majority of scientists. Sometimes, the new generation of paleontologists coming out of college, sometimes I think that there is a zest for disproving things that other scientists may have proposed of the past. It's a good thing. It's what science needs. But I think that sometimes we're so busy trying to disprove the obvious that we're not using the best science. When somebody tells me that the horns of a Triceratops were solely used for display, my answer to that is wrong. I completely disagree with that. Because the amount of energy it takes for the body to produce those horns doesn't make any sense that they have one function. Those are weapons. They are absolutely used as defensive ways to protect themselves. Why would they be as big? Why would they be so thick? Why would they be so prominent? Why do other dinosaurs have spikes on their shoulders and backs? And because these things are defensive weapons. So in my opinion, I think that sometimes, well, one other thing, sometimes a scientist may propose a guess, a hypothesis, but the media takes what they proposed and they glamorize it and they turn it into this person said this. They didn't say that. They proposed something. So I would say that what you read is inaccurate, in my opinion. What about you, Noah?
I agree the same way. Like you said, new generation of paleontologists, sometimes they make kind of goofy assumptions. And I mean, I'm not an actual paleontologist. So you may think, well, why is he saying that? That person is a paleontologist, so they should know best, right? So one of the most important things in paleontology any science actually, is to research and read a ton. You have to read a bunch of books, and then from all that, you read all of that, you have to take everything you've read and think about what makes the most sense. If you want, do your own research and come up with the best idea from what you've learned. It's good to learn from books, but you can't take one book as law. So that's really, really important. So you have to understand this stuff. We have evidence for Triceratops using its horns. We actually have marks on the frill of Triceratops from other Triceratops horns. And also kind of fun bit of information, the paleontologist who did that study, he did a study on whether or not Triceratops could ram their hands together, horns together, and lock and fight. And he actually did this with dinosaur toys.
Nice.
That's cool. Wouldn't you just love that? Be a paleontologist in your home.
And oh, yeah.
Your wife's hollering, "Honey, what are you doing? Come up and eat dinner. I'm playing with my dinosaur toys and doing science here. What do you think I'm doing?" Yeah.
Don't you know anything about science? One thing to keep up. One thing I want to add about books. A book is only as accurate as the day it was written, assuming that it was accurate to start off with. I have seen so many times children's books that call Giganotosaurus or Giganotosaurus Gigantosaurus. I see it over and over. I have to read it 3 or 4 times to make sure I'm not seeing things. Sometimes people that write books about prehistoric life have no understanding whatsoever. They simply take things from other people's work and they combine it and they create their own book. So somebody might say something like that and they assume it's fact and they don't do any research. So I have a book on my shelf right now that says Brachiosaurus lives in the ocean and its long neck was used for sticking its head out of the water to breathe. Well, that book was written in 1950s. But still, if that's the only book I read, that's what I would believe. So read as many books as you can. All right. How about we do a couple of...
Who would win? What if two different prehistoric creatures fought? Who would win? T-Rex versus a giant wolf? Raptor versus terror bird? Spinosaurus versus Triceratops. You choose the animals, and Dinosaur George will size them up and pick a winner. Now, get ready. It's time to find out who would win.
All right, one of the benefits of being a Patreon member in the Tyrannosaurus Club is that you get to submit who would wins. So we're going to go down some of these, and I'm going to pick a winner, and Noah, you'll pick your winner of it. So let's start with Spinosaurus wants to know, Carnotaurus versus a pack of Kellenkin. This is an interesting one. I'm going to say there are 4 Kellenkin. Go first, Noah. What do you think?
Oh, man. Kellenkin all the way. The Carnotaurus, great animal. But I don't know if it can handle 4 terror birds. Terror birds, in my opinion, were some of the most terrifying animals to have ever existed. I mean, Kellenkin was huge. Biggest of the terror birds. And it was fast. It wasn't as fast as some of the smaller ones, but it was fast. Carnotaurus is a basal dinosaur. That means it's very primitive. It doesn't have some of the aspects and characteristics newer dinosaurs had, like the raptors. And where did Kellenkin come from? The raptors.
Raptors.
And one of the biggest things I think Kellenkin has is, since you put it in a group, it's smart enough to be able to work with others. Carnotaurus, not that smart. I don't think Carnotaurus has a chance against these guys.
My opinion is Allosaurus would win. Okay, next question.
All right, let's go.
I agree with you. I think that Carnotaurus is such a primitive dinosaur that it doesn't have the ability. And that rounded snout is not made for reaching out and touching someone. You got to be really close. I don't think it's ever going to catch Kellenkin. And I do believe there would be enough. Now, Carnotaurus has an advantage in that it has some armor on it. some dermal scutes on it, but not enough and not covering enough of the body, in my opinion. I think Kellenkin would do them in a pack of them anyway. All right. This is from Phoebe Cephalosaurus. Diplodocus versus two Ceratosaurus. I'll go first. Even though Ceratosaurus is pretty amazing, I don't believe two is enough to take on an adult Diplodocus, because the tail swings both ways, right and left. Very much different than, say, Stegosaurus, who can only swing those spikes in one direction. Diplodocus can whip that tail around, crack it like a whip, and be able to, in my opinion, stand up on its back legs to be able to use its front feet as a weapon. I would say Diplodocus. What do you say in this one?
I don't see any way in the world Ceratosaurus wins.
Yeah.
Diplodocus, too big. Like you said, the tail, it's going to give it the reach. Two Ceratosaurus cannot do it, but Allosaurus could.
Yeah. Well, Allosaurus wins every fight.
Allosaurus wins everything.
It does. All right. Let's see. This is from Giganota Gibson. El Stinko versus Nanooksaurus. Okay, first of all, I am not El Stinko, so I can't speak for him. I don't know, but I would say this. If he has his stink bombs, he wins every battle. The end. There's no room for conversation. All right, Ray Rex from Falls City, Washington wants to know, Stegosaurus versus Triceratops. You go first.
All right. Putting me on the spot. This is a tough one. Now, this may be a bit biased because Stegosaurus is my favorite ornithischian of all time, but I think Stegosaurus would win. Thing is, Triceratops, it has the horns, but if you're going to get Stegosaurus, Stegosaurus is going to be planted on the side and Triceratops is going to be coming at it. That's how it's going to be. Stegosaurus's defensive posture is to the side to swing that tail. So it's basically making a T. And what that does is that T is going to curve in. And if it does curve in, it's not going to be good, because Triceratops really has no armor except at the front. And even if Stegosaurus does hit the front, I firmly believe it is not going to be good for Triceratops. I don't care how tough you are. If you have about 3 foot long spikes coming in at you at that high of velocity, that is going to cause in some major damage. If anything, I think Stegosaurus may even knock out Triceratops at this point, but I think that wouldn't happen. I think Stegosaurus can reach around and hit the body. What do you think?
Well, I think there's two things you'd have to consider. One is, what is the speed that the tail can be thrust forward? What is the speed that can be swung? And the second one is, I lost my train of thought. Speed. Second one is, how far around can it reach? So you make a good point. That is, Stegosaurus is going to be standing broadside to Triceratops to be able to utilize that tail. So as Triceratops comes in, imagine a matador, a bullfighter, how they kind of sidestep as the bull charges in, they sort of sidestep it. I would suspect that Stegosaurus is probably pretty mobile because its back legs are longer than its front. So its center of gravity is forward, and it might be able to sidestep. If it sidesteps as the charge comes and swings the tail simultaneously, it is moving that mass, and that tail is coming and would probably strike the Triceratops in the side. Now, that's an interesting battle, because if you could sidestep Triceratops like a matador, but you hit him with 4 spikes as he's going by, one hit is 4. Think of it as a torpedo in the side of a ship. 4 of those is going to cause traumatic internal injuries. I don't know. I'm torn between this, because Triceratops is certainly fast. I think fast. And if it's coming in from the front and Triceratops has to turn sideways to deploy any hope of survival, Can he turn fast enough, and can that tail come around far enough to be able to hit him? This is a tough one. I think I'm going to go with Stegosaurus. I think you make some pretty legitimate guesses. Okay, let's see. Let's do... let me see. I want to pick somebody else that hasn't loaded one yet. I'm trying to see if there's some that I haven't mentioned.
What about Jonathan Jadelos? I don't think he's done any.
Which one did he have? Read his. I don't see it on there.
Ooh, a mountain lion versus a short-faced bear.
Okay, I actually answered that on the podcast I recorded before this one. Oh, any of nice. Those where you see that I've clicked on the heart to love it, that means I've used it.
Got it. What about Velociraptor, Mosasaur versus Megalodon?
Mosasaur versus Megalodon is an interesting one. My go-to thing is always the same, and that is the ability for Mosasaur or for Megalodon to not have to break off the fight to come up to breathe. That I just can't get past that in my mind. I can't get past that. I think that's the definitive decision maker. But what's your opinion of it?
I'm actually going to do different than you. I think this is the first time today. But I think I'm going to go Mosasaur. I think the Mosasaur was slightly faster than Megalodon, and it was flexible, highly flexible, according to studies. And I believe that speed and flexibility in the water can really help. Because Megalodon, to me, it just doesn't seem very fast. Sharks aren't necessarily very fast, unless if they're coming up from a downwards angle. That's going to be the key. If Megalodon has the element of surprise and comes up and gets Mosasaurus, game over. If he doesn't, I think Mosasaurus is going to take him by just wearing him down.
That's good. All right, my friends. I hope you guys enjoyed today's podcast with Noah, my assistant, helping me out. It was fun for me to get different perspectives on some of the things. It's, you know, my opinion isn't any better than anyone else's, and it's nice to have differing opinions and different thoughts. For those of you that would like to see some of the stuff Noah does, please join our Patreon page. Go to dinosaurgeorge.com, click on the Patreon Club, and you'll see a link to where you can sign up. It's fun for everybody. Noah, I really appreciate you helping out doing this. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, sir, I did. It was a blast.
That's so cool. Well, for everybody out there, be safe. Stay warm if it's cold where you are. Stay cool if it's warm where you are. Thank you to all the listeners all around the world. Thank you for listening to this podcast and making it a success. Noah, you want to say goodbye to everybody?
Yes, sir. Adieu.
Adieu. He has to speak a different language, of course.
Okay. Exactly.
All right, you guys. Thank you all so much. We'll see you. See ya. Wouldn't want to be ya.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Dinosaur George Kids. Join the Dinosaur George Kids Facebook group, become a member of our Patreon club, and check out our website store for cool fossils, rocks, and crystals. Visit dinosaurgeorge.com for details. Until next time, keep digging for knowledge.